Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace. My guest today is the editor for the longest running comic book news outlet on the internet, Newsarama. He's written about comics and comic based media for USA Today, Publisher Weekly, Life, and many other outlets. He's a member of the American Library Association's Graphic Novel and Comic Book Roundtable, as well as the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund. He's been a judge for both the Eisner Awards as well as the Harveys. It's my pleasure to welcome back to the show, Chris Arendt. Chris, thanks for joining me.
Hey, thanks for having me. Hearing you read off that bio, it sounds like I've done a lot of stuff.
You have, man. I would consider you an expert on comics. I don't think that is a stretch by any means.
Oh, thank you. I should be able to use that on my tax returns for writing off all these comics.
Yeah, that's part of the reason that I wanted to have you on. I noticed over at Newsarama, you guys have been doing some articles recently about sales, you know, and I don't know about you, but pretty much ever since I started collecting comics, I've been hearing that rumor that the comics are dying, comics are going away, nobody reads comics anymore, comics are just for kids. And so I like to kind of push back on that a little bit. I think comics are in a good place, and that's even considering the sort of crazy, unprecedented year that we had in 2020 with the pandemic and lockdowns and that sort of thing. So from your perspective, how do you see comics in 2020? How did comics sort of weather the storm in your mind?
I think comics are generally they've recovered from the pandemic, but you got to step back and kind of realize when you say comics, what you're thinking, what you're actually talking about. It's not just comic books or even just trade paperbacks of comic books, but where the industry in itself, whether people want to admit it or not, includes like kids graphic novels, Dogman, adult graphic novels, comic strips, web comics, manga, of course, which is just comics. So in the bigger picture, I think comics are doing really well, especially considering the circumstances. For Newsarama, I'm tasked to primarily cover like the direct market, superhero, Marvel, and DC. But even in that, the industry has weathered this change in distribution and the distribution shutdown and then the changeover in distribution pretty well, considering when you and I talked previously, there was concern if I knew where we are today, I would consider this a big win because it could have been far worse. I do think the pandemic and the change in distributors, the pandemic kind of forced a couple things in the comics industry that was going to happen at one point or another. It just kind of forced that progression to happen quicker. Going back to the question of sales and raw numbers, there's in the direct market, there's still this concern of sales of comics as comics in terms of reading material. And then there's kind of this undercurrent of the sale of comics as this collectible. Comics has a long history of being collectible and it's kind of changed, but now this, instead of like back issue bins and stuff like that being kind of something every fan would deal with, that's kind of gone by the wayside. But instead there's this kind of chase for variant covers. And variant covers account for a large number of sales, especially in like the big two, Marvel and DC, in the direct market, especially when you talk about these like higher tier books that not are floated by variant covers, but are kind of helped by that, which I'm concerned if there's a bubble, like what would that be? But I don't even know there's a bubble. So maybe even saying that is jinxing it. But
yeah, I think a lot of people, they look at the crash in the 90s as sort of a warning sign. And they look at the variant market, the speculator market now, and they worry that history is repeating itself. But to those people, at least me, you know, cause I was around for that. I had a shop in the early 90s. So I'm intimately familiar with, you know, what was going on back then. Yeah, there's a lot of variant covers, but it feels a lot different this time around. It's not that same sort of, it doesn't have that same sort of feel of just being a money grab that it did back then, where they literally would slap a, you know, an X-Men or an X on, you know, it wasn't even just X-Men, but, you know, even independent publishers would slap an X on something, or they'd come out with some black and white comic that had like starring some animal that had like four different adjectives, you know, kind of trying to capitalize on Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. And they would just throw this stuff out there and people would buy it. It's not that way anymore. So I don't have as much worry about the speculator market now with some hindsight. Do you feel the same way about that, or do you have a different take?
Yeah, I think it's changed. And I think we're fortunate that we're not just, we don't just have the direct market now. To the direct market was never the only piece of the puzzle, but now it's become one of several pieces. And like you're saying, in the 90s, like, there was a joke, I don't think it's carried over, but kind of like the ever presence of Wolverine guest starring in everybody's books to like, yep, pump up numbers. And I think in the modern day, people realize that Wolverine's a major character, but I don't think they realize how much bigger he was in the context of what was going on in the 90s at the time, where, yes, he only had one book, but he would appear in everything.
There was a period in the mid 90s where if Marvel launched a new title, you could guarantee in the first 10 issues, you'd see Wolverine show up, Ghost Rider show up, and Punisher show up.
Mm-hmm. And I remember storylines in Marvel Comics Presents that was just kind of those three characters just running through it, and they would serialize it. But yeah, going to today, I think it's very different. Fortunately, the comics industry is kind of diversified into several platforms. Even now, when their Diamond is not the only direct market distributor, it's not a perfect situation, but I think it's if we have more legs to stand on, if one of the legs has trouble, then we don't automatically tip over. And I think between Diamond and with Lunar and Digital, which is pretty much Comixology, but there's others, and then the book trade, and then web comics, which is things like Tapas and Webtoon. There's a lot of different things kind of holding up the market. I do see people with kind of an insular view of comics as superhero comics, specifically Marvel and DC, and they're quick to chide any kind of downturn in sales they have on that front as a reflective, as kind of a report card on how they're doing things wrong, and kind of this nostalgic view of things were better before when I was younger. And that's not to say some comics were better or worse, but I think it's just a very different situation. And like, and even though superhero comics fans were built to have this kind of binary opposing forces view on things, like Superman versus Batman, Marvel versus DC, X-Men versus Fantastic Four, that kind of binary thinking is kind of out of touch with the way that comics are currently.
Yeah, I agree. And we certainly see that. You know, you mentioned Dogman earlier. My daughter, she's 9, she's a huge fan of Dogman. And I know those graphic novels sell millions of copies. You know, a lot of the material by Raina Telgemeier, same thing, you know, millions of copies, very successful. And what people don't realize is it's not just, you're not just seeing these things in comic stores. They're at Costco, they're at bookstores. And there's the whole Scholastic book market as well. So just because, you know, your local comic shop may have shut down because they didn't diversify enough with, you know, what's going on. And certainly my heart goes out to any retailer who's struggling. But I'm hearing from a lot of retailers that I know personally that 2020 was one of the best years they ever had. Have you been hearing something similar?
I'll admit that I wish I would have been able to speak with retailers more than I have, especially in these kind of trying times, but what I have spoke with and just what I've been impressed by is just the determination upon retailers who are these, you got to remember, like, I'm not speaking to you, but just the audience, that retailers are these independently owned stores. They're not part of corporate, so they each kind of have their own way of going things. How each of them that I spoke with have had this ingenuity and drive to kind of adapt with the circumstances. And yes, there's complaining, because complaining is the outlet for release of tension, but they've kind of adapted to the situation. And there's more paperwork now for people, retailers or ordering DC and Marvel. There's more distributors to deal with, but yeah, like I don't think that in terms of dollars coming in, I don't think it's been the big hit that people were fearing it would be. Like, I don't think this will be an overall great year, but it, like, the bottom didn't fall out as far as I can tell. I would love to be able to do some more reporting on that, or see some more reporting on that. But just anecdotally from those that I've spoke with, that it hasn't been a end of the world scenario. There hasn't been a large number of shops closing like there was in the 90s, where like comic shops, the number of comic shops in like a decade like dropped by half. I haven't heard of that kind of thing. There has been a graying of the market as some comic stores don't last, but then there's stories of new ones popping up or relocating or adapting to the time. So I hate to say the comics retail is healthy like right now, but they've taken some hits this year, but I think they're doing good considering all that's happened this year.
Yeah, it's a good way to look at it. They kind of look at it as all retail, right? I mean, everybody, these are not ideal situations, but you're right. I mean, I've seen some stores that have expanded their online presence. You know, we've seen curbside pickup, we've seen delivery, we've seen all kinds of things. And the other thing that at least I've seen in the podcast and hearing from listeners and people reaching out on social media, and we'll see if you have any experience with this over the past year, is some people rediscovering comics. You know, they can't spend money on going on vacation. Maybe they're stuck at home, working from home, have a little more disposable income. With not having to, you know, travel to work every day, you know, the commute or buy lunch or what have you. I've heard of a lot of people sort of, you know, nostalgia being a thing and being stuck at home and, hey, I'm bored. You can only watch so much TV. And people have been sort of rediscovering comics. Did you have any experience with that over the last year since we've been experiencing this pandemic?
I can say personally, I've probably spent more on comics or read more on comics than I would in a normal year. And there is that saying about like idle hands, and but in a positive way, they find new things or rediscover old things that they like to revisit. I would like to see that trend. That sounds like something that would help all of us and create a healthier industry, but I haven't seen the data to basically tell me that's happening, but that sounds like something that I would love.
So for you, you mentioned personally, it's something that, did you go looking for back issues? Did you reread stuff? How, from a personal perspective, how did it affect you?
I think with this, the free time, I've kind of better defined my work reading for Newsarama and then my kind of reading as a fan. I wouldn't say I've rediscovered my reading as a fan, but I've kind of had more time to go down these fields, and I've fully acclimated to reading as a fan digitally due to the pandemic and some things before that. So I've really chased down some things, and I'm subscribed to multiple of these unlimited services that that I'm not comped for, but nor I should I be, but kind of using those to chase down things. I'm reading multiple volumes of manga in one sitting has gone from an unusual occurrence to kind of a more common occurrence, and having all this available has been really helpful. And even just kind of rereading stuff that I've had on my bookshelf that I haven't read in years, or even going back to my back issue bins and rereading Larry Hama's G.I. Joe, the Marvel stuff from the 80s, and kind of re-understanding what was going on with that. So for me, I've spent more, I've read more, and I think that's it. Just personally, yeah, my spending and reading are up tremendously in the past 12 months.
Yeah, same here. In fact, the listeners will know this, but yeah, I basically rebuilt my Amazing Spider, which is the only run of comics that I ever sold. I had a huge run of Amazing Spider-Man from around 240, 250 up past 400. Mm-hmm. And I sold it, you know, and included, you know, Hobgoblin and all the Mark McFarlane issues and Carnage and all that. And yeah, regretted it almost immediately. So I rebuilt that from now my Spider-Man run goes from pretty solidly from 200 up to, you know, to the current day. I'm only missing a few issues here and there, and I'm working my way down now. So yeah, I've definitely spent a lot more on comics myself. So what do you think are going to be some of the most impactful, lasting changes to the market that we've seen from 2020? I know you mentioned distributors. So talk a little bit about that and anything else you think is going to be a lasting impact from the changes we saw in 2020.
I think there's going to be a lot. There was a lot of book trade, graphic novels, adult and juvenile, that was kind of put on hold in 2020. That I think there's, I wouldn't say there's a full backlog, but I think there's 2021 is going to be a good year. I think in terms of the quality of releases, and the on like the webcomics front with like Webtoon and Tapas and all that. I think I still think there's some disconnect between average comics readers and the work being produced there. And meanwhile, the work being produced there is creating this whole new audience of fans. I think there's going to be some measures there where that kind of disconnect is not completely resolved, but I think there'll be some more crossover with popular hits like Lore, Olympus becoming more of a, instead of a niche thing for people in the direct market, will become more of a understood and appreciated as a hit, similar to the way manga rose in the late 90s and into the 2000s and kind of crept up on direct market minded comics people. Going back to the direct market, as far as distribution, where when we started 2020, Diamond was the primary distributor, and how it's kind of switched where DC left and helped jumpstart two new distributors, and then it's kind of went back down to one distributor with a Lunar. There is a scenario where I could see DC going back with Diamond, but I wouldn't place money on it. But if they did, I think Diamond would have to have some major infrastructure changes to make it a place where DC wants to put their money and their resources in, considering the stuff that's happened, that's been reported, and some stuff that I've heard that is, I don't want to say troubling, but there's concerning things. There would be some big issues that would have to be addressed, I think, for DC to go back with Diamond. Lunar, I will say that I know the owners of Lunar. I don't know if it's conflict of interest. I know the owners of Diamond, but I've been impressed with what they've been able to do. And I know it's not perfect, but I think given where they were at the beginning of 2020 and what they've been able to do as a distributor, it's not like Steve at Diamond, where he had, what was it, like 13, 15 years before he was carrying like Marvel and DC as their exclusive. I think Christine and everyone there at Lunar have done a lot. Like, it'll be interesting to see once they're out of basically panic mode and getting this new business off the ground, if they can build some infrastructure things and build out that business I think for them that could result in some positive things, but it's still a risky proposition. The pandemic's still going on. Like, we can't really forget that.
Right.
Any kind of investments into business is going to be a careful thing, because they don't want to tip over and run out of money for the short term while planning for the long term.
Yeah, it's a good point. And we're definitely still seeing supply chain pinches in terms of manpower. And, you know, I'm hearing things of a lot of Kickstarter books that are printed overseas are sitting in the port of Los Angeles for 10 days just waiting to get unloaded. So, yeah, we're still sort of in the midst of this. So time will tell. I did want to ask you, because I've thought about this as well. I definitely see a scenario where DC goes back to Diamond, but I don't think that precludes them from staying with Lunar as well. I think the healthiest thing would be to, you know, give retailers that option. Hey, do you want to get your books, you know, all from Diamond, or do you like the way Lunar does things? I think more options and competition breeds, you know, innovation and kind of keeps everybody, you know, on the right path. What do you think about that?
I think it's possible. My concern is with DC as a whole, especially for someone like Lunar, if they're not handling all of DC's direct market orders, I don't know how financially viable it would be for them to take part of it. Even though Lunar, like you and I know this, but for people listening, Lunar is owned by discountcomicbookservice.com, which is one of the arguably the largest single comic book retailer. They sell comics. The nostalgic term for this is mail order, but they do it online. They were, up until this year, Diamond's number one retail customer. They're buying as a store, like your local store does, like wherever you are, and then basically reselling to the public. But even then, if they're not handling all of DC's direct market orders, I don't know if the lower volume would still result in enough profit margin for them to continue. I haven't physically seen the inside of their operations, but I think it would still be beneficial to them. I don't know if Lunar's not all the way in with DC, I don't know if it's worth it for them to be halfway in. This does kind of expose the question. Like, before the pandemic, there's people who called Diamond a monopoly, which they were. I don't know illegally if the laws against it fit that, but now we kind of see what a alternative is when Diamond's not a monopoly. If DC and Diamond could get on the same page, not to be exclusive, but to be the primary. Like, you got to remember, Diamond is carrying DC's product outside North America for what they call Diamond UK, but that ships to several places in addition to the UK. I could see them doing that, but I don't really have a good answer. I've just kind of walked through my thought process out loud, and I could see it working, but I don't know if it would work for especially a Lunar, because for a Lunar, DC is the near exclusive comic books that they distribute as Lunar. So I'm not sure.
Do you think it would be like, so let's take it to the other extreme. Let's say that Lunar keeps distributing. They don't have the whole piece of the pie for DC, but they managed to get the other publishers as well. So now you basically have two competing distributors. Do you think that's, like, not in terms of, is that good for Lunar as a business? Is that good for Diamond as a business? Obviously having the whole pie is better for them, but for the comic industry as a whole, you know, thinking about it from the perspective of the publishers, the retailers and the fans, do you think it's better to have more than one distributor?
There's a lot of variables there. The one thing that the primary concern here is currently all of the comics that are distributed by Diamond are pretty much exclusive to Diamond, and all the comics distributed by Lunar, which is DC, are exclusive to Lunar, unless you want to use one of the book trade When I use, when I'm, before, like an analogy I use to this is, imagine if you're grocery shopping and you have two grocery stores in town and they both carry the same stuff, but maybe the price is different and something like that. And maybe there's some things that one store has that the other store has. But we're currently like in a situation where one store has all of this one brand of item. That's one of the biggest brands. And then this other store has the other big brand and everything else. So it's kind of a hard thing. Like, could I see Lunar taking on more publishers? Definitely could see that. The issue is that most of the other larger publishers with Diamond are locked into exclusive agreements that I'm not sure. DC had a clause in their contract where they could, Newsarama broke the story on this, where they could, even though they're exclusive, with a 6-month notice, basically break the exclusive. I'm not sure that Marvel and the other ones have that. You add to that that Diamond also acts as the book trade distributor for Image Comics and others. And so that would be a harder break. Because not only for retailers, when they were dealing with one distributor, they had one set of paperwork, one set of bills, one contact. With two distributors, that's twice the amount of paperwork. If Image and Marvel were to go unexclusive with Diamond, they would also have two sets of paperwork, two sets of books. It's not impossible. Like, this is the way the comics were before 94, 95. But I think it would be a difference, playing field that I don't think that they would be too excited to jump into unless they had to. But if Lunar could do it, I think there would be some real room to, if they could do it successfully and stably, I think it would make for a healthier industry. But I think there would be more behind the scenes, like issues that to be dealt with, that can be dealt with, but it's more than what people are used to currently.
Yeah, I mean, it's a long path to get there, because I think you're right. I mean, ultimately, as a retailer, you want to just deal with one distributor. You want, you know, everything to be available from that distributor, but you probably want the choice, you know, from their perspective, let me have the choice of which one I think is, you know, suits my business model best. But yeah, the problem right now is they're dealing with double, you know, there's two. As you said, you know, it's like you can only get Coke at this store and, you know, Pepsi and everything else is at this store. It's like, you got to go to both, you know, you don't have a choice.
And it's, do you go to both and there's more paperwork hassle and things like that? And then if you're we're getting really deep into it, but if your retailers get a discount on their wholesale price of books based on how much they order as a whole. So if what they were spending all their money with Diamond and they would get a higher level of discount, if they're now splitting their money, even if not 50-50, if like 40-60, their discount would be less, so their distributing would be, basically selling the books would be less profitable for them on a profit margin per book basis. But also there's more paperwork involved and just I used to work in the restaurant business, basically more ways for things to go wrong.
Yep.
But it could be worth that hassle. If you're retailers want the one distributor, the negative to that is, if everybody has one distributor, then the distributor sets the terms and it's a take it or leave it scenario.
Yeah, exactly. And the other thing is that they may be paying more in shipping because now they're, you know, paying for two shipments instead of the one shipment may not weigh as much. So the shipping may be less, but I guarantee you it's still more, you know, having to get books from two different places. The shipping is more than it is from getting it from one place.
Yeah, there's ways that could be solved where in other industries they've have, but like weekly shipping of books, like if they could extend the, at a loss for words for it now, where they hold the books. But I could see a scenario where maybe Diamond or Lunar ships 2 weeks worth of books at a time or have that as an option, but they'd have to have stricter embargo dates to make sure no one broke the embargo.
Yeah.
I could see something like that happening, but it's something modern comics retailers, except for the more forward-thinking ones that are already dealing with book trade may not be used to or and familiar with on how to make the most of that kind of system where you're dealing with multiple distributors.
Yeah, it's a lot for sure. And then, you know, this I know we're listeners were talking about this from a retailer's perspective, but remember this affects the readers and the fans too, because, you know, when you're talking about profits and you're talking about, you know, retailers being able to keep their doors open to be able to get the books in a timely manner. I mean, it all affects everything, and we all want a healthy industry. You did mention earlier, Chris, about some of the book trade things and more adult graphic novels and such being pushed back a year. Do you think there's still room for everything? It's not going to be a situation like we have in the film industry where all of a sudden everything is super crowded and there's not even room for everything. Do you anticipate any impact with maybe lower sales, you know, for one particular book or another versus, you know, I would think overall it would be about the same, but we're not looking at a place where the market's going to be too crowded, do you think, are we?
I think in terms of storefront and just a customer's dollars, I don't think the release of, like, say, if a Randa Telgemeier book came out the same week or month as Dave Pilkey, I don't think that they would eat into each other's customers too much. I do think there's just I think the bottleneck will be in the marketing and distribution phase of it. And they might be more, publishers might be more rushing to get the bigger ones out. Because if assuming the bigger ones cost more money, they don't start earning their money back until they go on sale. So if it's a smaller book, that they may be okay holding on to that debt on their account longer if they can get more of these, what they may deem as more surefire hits out the door and get basically paying off the advances and the print runs that they have for that. So I do think basically some of the bigger books will be front loaded once that happens. And I don't know, there's still room for it. It's I don't understand the market as well as I want to, but I think it's going to be a higher frequency of bigger books, or what the publishers view as what is going to be their bigger books to get back on track.
Gotcha. Yeah, that makes sense. Do you think there's any big changes still to come that we haven't seen or felt the impact of? That maybe like you had mentioned earlier, some of these changes with, you know, distributors and other things had probably already been coming, and the pandemic just sort of, you know, sped it up a little. Do you think there's any more of that coming, either changes to the market that have been sort of forced along by the pandemic, or changes that were coming anyway that are just, it's just time for them to happen?
As you were telling me that question, the first thing that came to mind for me is DC. We've already seen them reduce the number of single issue ongoing series they're doing in favor of doing more original graphic novels and things like that. And there's been some change in management there. I expect a lot of changes there. I'm looking a lot at their digital first line. In some cases, they're not digital first. They're digital only for the time being, where there's I'm interested to see where that's heading. And the potential for that, like last year, you saw them like even doing original comics on Instagram. It was comics as marketing for James Tynion's Batman book, but original comics on Instagram as a test. And like, I'm sure they weren't just doing that as a one-off situation. They were paying attention to that. So I'm interested to see what DC has planned next, especially with the advent of the DC Universe Infinite digital reading platform. I'm interested to see where that goes. I think there's going to be some definite movement on the digital platform, and even the idea of, I don't know if you follow TV, but if you saw recently, NBC Universal's Peacock streaming service bought the rights to WWE had their own streaming service called WWE Network, and they paid this sum to basically take over the whole thing and just make it part of Peacock for 5 years. It would be an interesting scenario if say Amazon with its Comixology decided to pay the money for DC or Marvel to make that just part of Comixology Unlimited for 5 years. I think Marvel would be more inclined to do that than DC would, but, and that's just a hypothetical. I haven't heard anything. This isn't a rumor or anything. It's just kind of idle speculation. I think there's some interesting things that could go there. As far as publishers, outside of that, I think 2021 is just is going to be a chance for them to catch up from 2020 and the things they wanted there and just try to have a normal year. All these publishers have changed in terms of staffing and focus and revenue models in 2020. I think they've had enough interior change to basically do things the same for a year in some cases, but I think in other cases, there's changes that were propagated by the pandemic or hurried along by the pandemic that we just haven't seen yet that we'll see more of the effects of as they're announced. Because you know that the publishers right now are planning things that won't happen for, that we won't know about unless someone leaks, which they're more than welcome to email me, like any leaks you want, and I'll verify and run it. But they're planning out 2-3 years. There's some people in some offices planning 5-10 years out. So I think there could be a lot of changes there. In terms of distribution, I think we pretty much covered that. I think digital, I think is kind of where I can see a lot of things kind of shifting depending on the year we have.
Yeah, and it's an easy thing to speculate about just because it makes so much sense. You know, when you don't have to pay for shipping and you don't have to pay for printing, you know, from a publisher standpoint, it's such an easy thing to do to kind of boost your bottom line. Because I find it interesting with the things that DC is doing as well. And I wonder, I feel like from what I've been hearing from listeners is that they're worried that the quality of DC is declining. You know, all of a sudden we see a lot of unfamiliar names over there. They're not creators that they're used to. They're not really, at least from what I'm hearing from our fan base is that the Future State books aren't kind of hitting that sweet spot that the DC fans have become used to. And so there's worry. Is this just growing pains of the changes, or does this kind of forecast, you know, what's to come? And I'm just telling, like, I don't know. Really think it's too soon to say. Are you kind of feeling sort of the same thing? And I know this is all speculation. And my thought is we're not probably going to know for a while, maybe midsummer, until we get a chance to kind of see what comes next for them. What are you have any thoughts on that?
In terms of DC, I do think the change in the number of new fresh creators or creators that were maybe doing anthologies and smaller books before getting shots at bigger ones with Future State. But I really don't, that's partly it's the cyclical nature of comic books. Like you saw this in the tail end of with Flashpoint leading into New 52. You saw this in the 90s and the changeover in creators led by the Image Exodus, but also the influx of the new British writers and what they call the British invasion of all these new writers that people haven't heard of that are replacing their favorite writers from the 70s and the 80s. I think it's part of that shift. And just the people I'm seeing, I think there's more, it's more open to different people. So there's more diversity to it, which I think will lead to more opportunities for the strongest, most creative voices to really break out in a way that they couldn't before. But it is a transition. Like the comics fans like what they're used to, and they would like to see that. But I think comics is also growing in a way that, yeah, there's for those that say that DC is not like it used to, I still think there's places there for it. But I think the level of it that you came to kind of expect, the basically the number of titles that are the DC that you remember is definitely going to be less, but I think it's still there. It's just now, like, those are fighting with different fan bases and different the audiences, and even the same audiences that are trying for something different. I will say that Future State was it seemingly was kind of built kind of like the retroactive crossover like event books and things like that as a way to give the ongoing titles like a 2-month break. So that's why you don't see a lot of the regular people from the ongoing books involved with the Future State books, unless they have the time. But even like people like James Tynion, who I'm sure wanted to be involved with Future State, he's pretty busy.
Yeah.
So I think it was a chance to try out new people, and that's part of the process. Like these are new names, but everybody was a new name once. Like Scott Snyder got his start doing a themed Iron Man book that no one remembers, and he was a new name. But he kind of took hold, and I think there's definitely more people like Scott Snyder in terms of this a prodigious talent that'll grow in a couple of years. I think there's several of those in the Future State lineup. So it is change, a part of it. While at the same time, you see some older creators coming back and doing work. Like if I were to tell you, hey, there's a new Fabian Nicieza book, X-Men book coming out. Then after that, Walt and Wheezy are doing X-Factor again. Like, how surprised would you be if I told you that like a year ago?
Yeah. Yeah.
And they have Chris Claremont doing these like kind of specialty X-Men books that they're kind of treating. It's not really hitting their direct market directly yet, but it will be kind of doing these books as part of his exclusive contract again. I think there's still room for the new and kind of picking up kind of the greatest hits of the old out there. It's but it's just a matter of the mix. But this is part of the trend in Marvel Comics and DC Comics and every comics is kind of this. There's always new creators coming in, and then some of your favorite older creators moving on to other comics, jumping around, going into other industries and things like that. I do think there's going to be a couple surprises in terms of more major Marvel creators maybe showing up in other places in the next year. I can't really say more than that, but I think it'll be something like interesting that might appease people.
Yeah, when we talk about Marvel, so there was a good period of time where it felt like they were relaunching all their major series with a new number one every year. Until those number one, kind of the cachet and the specialness of number ones sort of faded away. I think with C.B. Cebulski taking the reins, that has gone by the wayside, and things have been a lot more kind of stable over there in terms of series lasting a little longer, almost to the point that I wonder if they are going to do anything, because they see what's happening over at DC with this kind of shakeup of titles and this influx of new talent. Do you think there's any chance that Marvel does something similar this year in terms of an influx in talent or kind of relaunching some books with new number ones to try to go back to a little bit more to that older model of, hey, here's a great jumping on point?
Yeah. I'll say this, when they relaunch them this isn't kind of like an attack back against that, but the reason they relaunch things at number one is because people tend to order more that way. It makes a clear signal that it's a jumping on point. And yes, that kind of relaunch for number one kind of became the sales bump became less pronounced. So Marvel and DC, I think, have become more restrictive on when they do that and when they don't. Which is something that I appreciate, that they're not just doing it because this is what we do, but kind of looking at it in each scenario and deciding if this is the way we want to go. as for new talent, like this is pure speculation. I would look just from the names on the page and where they were before and where after. Look at what Jordan White and CB did with the X-Men line in terms of, okay, who are the top creators on that now? Where were they a year prior to their X-Men books being announced, when they would assumedly be in consideration and be recruited for that? And you'll see a lot of some weren't even at Marvel a year prior to the X-Men books debuting. Some, like Benjamin Percy, was jumped over from DC as like a major hire from over there. Then you had Teeny that was doing smaller work, and Leah who was doing smaller work, and Vita, they were doing work elsewhere, maybe here or there. And the artist, I think, given all the success in terms of sales, but critically, like, and also in terms of the infrastructure and kind of the pipeline that Jordan has set up as an example, I think we could see more of that, especially in the Spider-Man titles, but also possibly in the other titles, like the Captain America books, the Avengers books. I think there's a real chance for that, following kind of what Jordan has set up. I'm sure with help from Tom and Nick Lowe and everybody else there, but I really see that kind of transition as the model of how they recruit and how they bring people in and how they make it part of a team.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I'm glad you brought up that kind of X-Men team, because yeah, those people were brought on like long before it was announced, because we all know how far in advance Jonathan Hickman likes to plan things. And then yeah, they got to announce it all at once. And those are some really great young voices in the industry that you're mentioning, you know, Leah and Vita and Tinny and you know, Benjamin. I'm fans of all of them, and not only what they're doing with X-Men, but the stuff from before that. So yeah, I think if that's the direction that Marvel goes, I think that's a great model and a great way to, because you're bringing them in, these newer voices, and they're feeding off each other rather than just, you know, bringing them in and, okay, you're on this book and you're on this book and everybody's in a silo. Because it also fosters that sense of coming up together and you know, learning the ropes of how we're going to do things at Marvel together, you know, like you're a team.
Yeah, I think it builds a camaraderie that you can kind of see on the page. And even like you see some writers with like part of the launch that ended up their books ending and them not doing anymore. But they bring on kind of other staff, kind of like a football team where they have their first string players and somebody gets injured and then they loop in somebody else.
Right. Yeah.
And I think the fan base for that, the X-Men fan base, is pretty organized and rabid, and they're very enthusiastic, and I like that. And I think it was a good pairing for that kind of camaraderie of the creators to kind of be public and it catch on with the fan base. I'm not saying that formula is replicable for every fan base, but I do think there's scenarios where families of titles, where it can be more fully embraced, and that kind of modern, I don't want to use the word bullpen, but I'll say bullpen and someone will criticize me. but that kind of approach and that kind of the marketing of that as kind of a bullpen, a group of writers working together, and you'll see them co-writing books officially and unofficially, guest writing each other's books, like Vita on Marauders. And I think that's a good thing. It's kind of like the modern iteration of, I guess the last major one would be the writing groups that did the weekly books, like the New 52s and the Brand New Day.
Yeah, kind of like almost a virtual bullpen. Whenever I think about teams like that, I always go back to my kind of favorite era of Superman, where it was the Triangle era, where you had the teams from all four of the Superman books that, yeah, they were doing their own thing on their book, but they worked so closely together. They really were a team.
Yeah, and it kind of harkens back to this nostalgic time where, for good or for bad, like in the 70s and before that, and most of the writers not and the artists lived in New York and could hang out and good communicate like ideas. And you also had like editors basically doing a lot of writing too, but there was that interconnectedness, that kind of continuity that Stan Lee kind of really popularized, kind of coming forth just by them virtually working side by side and having these Slack chats or Discords or Clubhouse meetups.
Yep, yep, you're right, 100%. How are creators feeling? I mean, I know you know a ton of creators just like I do. Do you have a sense of how they're feeling about the industry with the challenges of 2020 and things kind of changing a little bit at DC and such? Is there anything you can say, you know, kind of in broad strokes there?
Up front, I'll say that pretty much every comics creator is a freelance independent contractor with no benefits. Job security is pretty hard to come by. There's guarantees for like, you'll get 12 issues on this, but even those, in some cases, those guarantees aren't in writing unless it's an exclusive contract where you're guaranteed a set amount of work per year. But I think in 2020, like you saw some of this kind of behind the scenes stuff kind of popping up and coming to the surface, and I can talk about it. Like you had James Tynion on his newsletter, which everybody should subscribe to, explain how when the pandemic set basically came about, he was writing deep the Batman title for DC, and he was concerned about it and had come up with a backup plan where he would basically, if like he had conversation with Scott Snyder to help him launch his creator own imprint if things came to that. And that's the writer of Batman, who 2 issues a month is a pretty full-time thing. And they're doing a video game based on his Detective Comics run, and just that job insecurity or just uneasiness of basically planning like what their work's going to be like 3, 6, 8, 9, 12 months from then. And then you see someone like Cullen Bunn, who has been kind of the unheralded, basically hardest working man in comics, who writes published as more comics out per month than anybody for Marvel, DC, and everybody. And he was pretty open that after nearly a decade of writing for Marvel, like he turned in his last Marvel thing and there wasn't, as far as he knew, like anything new coming. And you could detect a little bit of sadness for that, but I think it's just kind of part of the industry, and kind of that's in many cases of kind of the trajectory of careers for some creators. As far as 2020, I was saying, for publishers, I think they would kind of like to have a nice, boring, uneventful, no bad surprises, just steady work in 2021, and just be able to fill out their schedules with guaranteed work and no basically changes on the horizon. Because like we reported on some of it and otherwise, but once the pandemic really took effect, the people realized what it was. Like some people with books were told to basically stop working on it. And you don't, for that, you don't get paid unless you work, unless you turn in pages. And they're pretty much saying, we don't need you right now. We'll hear back from you soon. It's kind of like if you have a lawn person where you tell them, summer's over, we won't need you again for 6 months kind of thing. And that's just part of the freelance situation. That's why you see a lot of creators like diversify with different publishers. So what was your question again? I'm sorry.
Just how do you think the creators are feeling overall now that we've kind of dealt with this, and hopefully we're starting to see a light at the end of the tunnel?
Yeah, I think there's definite light at the end of the tunnel. I think there's more, they have more reason to be optimistic now than they did maybe 6 months ago. I think we're still not definitely out of the woods, and I still think publishers are still not making too big of plans at once. They may kind of stutter it out, but I think there's the possibilities there, and there's the potential there, but it's still not back to normal. I don't think they'll ever be a normal, but this kind of adjusting to this new situation and hoping nothing further comes along to kind of shake this kind of precarious industry, and especially for freelancers. Like, I really feel for basically freelancers and independent contractors who are kind of dealing with this, and the lack of job security is a very real thing. That's even before the pandemic, but especially now.
Yeah, well, I mean, to your point of you know, pencils down, it's not work. You had a number of creators that, you know, they have a body of work that they can still fall back on in terms of, you know, it has a fan base. If you can go to conventions and, you know, do signings and, you know, get out there and you're visible, but they didn't even have that option either, because, you know, this sort of pandemic situation where we found ourselves in, you didn't even have that. And for some of these, especially for artists, you know, a significant portion of their income could come from being at conventions, selling prints, doing commissions and things like that, selling merchandise. And so, yeah, I mean, I really feel for them. It's such a, as you said, an unstable sort of job market for them, that free.
I will say, for the people that use Comic Convention as a business, I'm not talking about the Comic Convention organizers themselves. I have friends in those industries. Like, I don't think that they've been able to adapt as well as, say, the comics distribution has. I don't even know that it's possible. Like I wanted to like the online conventions, but so far it's kind of kind of been the Diet Coke or the off brand of kind of what you're hoping for.
But
I've seen some art, like artists and writers kind of like we're talking about, the retailers kind of be resourceful, and they might open up more commission spots and kind of go more the route that Adam Hughes has done with selling original artwork. He kind of has tried to adapt, or at least bring in some revenue in a different manner possible. Like, I do think once conventions are safe again, and I it's up to each person to determine what safe is for them, I think people will welcome that. Like, as we speak, there's comic conventions that still happen, but smaller, more kind of unusual, not to the degree we're used to. And I just reported, as we record this, that Image and Skybound are looking at having a comic convention on a cruise ship in 2022 or 2023, which is, looks like they're at least hopeful, or at least thinking kind of past the pandemic, and kind of seeing what's what. So as far as of right now, San Diego's still scheduled for July. New York Comic Con's not scheduled. C2E2's scheduled for, I believe, November or December of this year. So we'll kind of see where that goes. Like, I would welcome conventions back when it's safe for everybody, not just physically, but just mentally to enjoy the experience.
Right, exactly. I don't see San Diego happening in July personally. I just can't see us getting there. Toward the end of the year, if enough people get the vaccine and numbers look okay, yeah. But even, I think even when they come back, there's going to be a period of time for everybody to adjust, to feel comfortable again. Because, I mean, you and I both know how it's just some of the bigger shows, New York and San Diego especially, it's just a sea of humanity. Even before this pandemic, I was worried about, you know, getting sick. And, you know, that's only been exacerbated.
Like, I will say this, moving comic conventions at different times of the year, and some, like, comic conventions are bound by the cities they're in. Like you won't expect to see San Diego announce they're moving to Vegas due to the pandemic, but, or something like New York Comic Con rescheduling for January. That doesn't sound thrilling for people, or C2E2 in the middle of the winter. But San Diego has that, a luxury that if, say, they did reschedule for December, like the first week of December, San Diego in December is not that bad, especially compared to maybe Chicago in December, or New York in December. So I think if they did determine that, hey, we can't do this in July, but if we kick the can down 6 months, like, we could do something close to it. And the way they're such a factor in the framework of the city of San Diego, I think the city of San Diego would be up for it. Like, even if they had to, cancel their Christmas parade or put it in the middle of the convention to have all these people come and have the revenue come in. I think they would be willing to do that. So
yeah, definitely. Another thing that creators have done, we've seen an influx this year, and I wanted to get your thoughts on it, is kind of the creator-owned crowdfunded model. And, you know, we saw some big names do some things at Kickstarter and such. Do you think we'll see that trend continue? Or as we come out of the pandemic, do you think that that'll kind of, it was just sort of a way to bridge the gap?
Oh, no, I definitely think this is, I don't want to say the way of the future, but I think this is one of those trends that was kind of hurried along faster than it would have been due to the pandemic. But I don't think that's going anywhere. I have some, you're kind of, a couple of questions you're asking me are hitting upon stories that I'm working on that I want to tell you the results, but I want to publish it on Newsarama first. But I think Kickstarter
100%
going to be around, and there's going to be some things happening in 2020 where it kind of becomes this, the uniqueness of Kickstarter kind of fades away, and it kind of becomes, I don't want to say fully embraced, becomes a part of the routine. And as this, in some ways, a de facto third distribution avenue alongside Diamond, Lunar, Book Trade, webcomics, things like that. In some cases, they'll have secondary distribution with Diamond, like the way Scott Snyder and Tony Daniels' Noctera is. But in some cases, it will be sold only on Kickstarter, and it'll be like you see all these third-party companies that are springing up as part of it. They kind of have this ecosystem of a Kickstarter, basically campaign for fulfillment and marketing and things like that. I think it's, I think Boom's usage of it has been not perfect. I don't think it's been a failure. I think it's kind of somewhere in the middle, and they've shown kind of effort to learn and adapt and fix the mistakes. And I think I could see other publishers trying it. Like right now, you see it a lot on the creator level. When numerous like image books right now began life as Kickstarter books, where before that was kind of a rarity with things like a Rocket Girl. Now it's becoming more of the norm. I could really see that happening more as it becomes normal for people, and they're seeing how it is just a different way in some cases for people, for customers to buy comics in a different way than they're used to. So yeah, I definitely think Kickstarter is going to be a big part of 2021.
Cool. And Chris, as long as we're kind of on the subject, you mentioned, you know, having work coming out on Newsarama, why don't you let everybody know where they can follow you online? Obviously you can go to Newsarama, but I know you always post when you have articles up and such, and even other articles from Newsarama. So why don't you tell everybody where they can find you online, social media and such?
Best place you can find me is at Newsarama, which is part of GamesRadar. You can find us at newsarama.com or gamesradar.com. We tend to publish 5 days a week, sometimes on the weekend for special circumstances. And we try to have a good mix of things. We are more leaning towards the direct market, but I'm trying to kind of pick my punches and kind of expose more of the different sides of the industry. Like have a couple stories on Dogman coming up, have a couple industry stories, which are kind of you seem to be interested in, regarding kind of numbers, sales numbers, these kind of big picture view of different aspects of the industry, how it kind of adds up. Like I'm also on Twitter talking about comics, other stuff. Sometimes it's like a release valve for the things going on in my workday. Sometimes it's kind of things that kind of didn't make it to the final edition of Newsarama that I'll post on there, like some nice artwork or just kind of like an aside or just some weird context on something that's going on. I have a lot of fun with it. Like today, like as we speak, this X-Men vote's currently happening, and I was able to tweak the X-Men logo design by Tom Mueller and turn it into a voting thing, and I had some fun with that. But that's pretty much what we've been up to.
Yeah, I saw that Tom Mueller inspired thing. That was really cool. One last question before I let you go, Chris. How do you feel about the impact in comics media, you know, as far as the pandemic? You know, we've seen TV shows and movies, that whole industry has been kind of thrown out of whack with the pandemic as well. Do you think we'll eventually everything will sort, as we come out of the pandemic, everything will sort of resort back to where it was before? Or do you think we're going to see so many long lasting impacts for the comics in other mediums?
I don't think I'm smart enough to be able to answer that definitively. I'm hopeful. But also going back to what we said, like about how the pandemic in some ways hurried along some changes in the industry. Not to say that we should benefit from the pandemic, but I'm kind of like interested in how these things operate when we don't have like looming death and political turmoil, like kind of under the surface, when how people can act during kind of less stressful times. So I'm hopeful that things will kind of go back where maybe people don't have to worry about some things as much as they have been these past 12, 14 months, and people can maybe worry about some more trivial stuff and maybe not take it so seriously. Like I remember a time when one of the main things people worried about was Superman's trunks. And like I would like to basically have the real world not be so stressful, so people can enjoy comics more fully. And like also enjoy the fandom of comics in a more a richer way without it being so cutthroat.
Yeah, I agree. It'd be nice if that was our biggest worry, was Superman's trunks.
Yeah.
All right. Well, again, thank you, Chris, for joining. It's been great to catch up with you again. I'll put links to Newsarama and Chris's social media in the show notes, everybody, so you can go click there and find it. And we once again want to thank everybody for listening, as always, and we'll talk to you next time.
You can find the Comic Source Podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whichever podcasting app you prefer. Please tell all your friends about us, subscribe, and rate us. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. Also, be sure to visit us at lrmonline.com to join the conversation, access the show notes, and discover all our other great pop culture content. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. So once again, we want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.